So it is approximately, according to the Vedic literature, 1 million years ago that Lord Ramachandra was on the planet. So according to modern historical references that may not be entirely seen in the same way, well, that is according to the Western historical records, Lord Ramachandra, if he was at all recognized as a historical personality, would have been much more recent. However, the Puranas, which are the Vedic history books, are giving us a different perspective on the matter. The Vedic history books are explaining in the Treta Yuga, which is approximately, we have Kali Yuga, 437,000, plus we have Dwapara Yuga, 864,000. So add the two, then we're looking at the end of the Treta Yuga. So 1.3 million approximately years ago was the Treta Yuga. Somewhere in that Treta Yuga, Lord Ramachandra. So that's the version that we accept here. Because we take it that 1 million years ago on this planet there was highly advanced civilization. 1,000 years ago there was a civilization in some ways more advanced than ours. Spiritually, society was of a higher caliber, much higher caliber then. Individual powers were much greater than today. Great kings were ruling the world, who were saintly kings. And Lord Ramachandra is the ultimate of saintly kings. He's the emblem of one who fully satisfied his citizens. So that's very unusual, because normally the citizens are always dissatisfied with the government. That's the daily pastimes. So that is there. Now, the basis of our discussion is the Ramayana. The Ramayana is divided up into different sections. First, there is an introduction, and the introductory section is describing how Ravana, who was a great demoniac personality, but at the same time someone of very great power, who could not see the real purpose of power, who rather misused that power. Bhagavad Gita explains, Balam Balavadam Chaham Kamaragin Vivarjitan. It says that the strength of the strong is meant to protect the weak. But Ravana was using his strength to exploit, which is, of course, not uncommon in the history of the world. Ravana, however, was an extremely powerful personality, very handsome and fierce, powerful built, huge, enormous, with a piercing, penetrating look, and yet also quite attractive. So Ravana, in that way, was a man who was particularly interested in the opposite sex. It says Ravana lived in Lanka, a golden city which he had conquered, a city of inconceivable opulence. That city of great opulence, there was Ravana's palace, and within that palace there were thousands and thousands of beautiful damsels who were all his harem, Ravana, in this way, was not only conquering the universe, but conquering many women as well. Sometimes even by force. However, in the course of those activities, in the course of taking women by force, he was cursed. Cursed by powerful demigods. And as a result, Ravana was experiencing some fear, because he knew that curses of such personalities sometimes come true. And therefore, from that day on, he restricted himself. And after all, what woman in the world could resist him? So it wasn't a problem anyway. In this way, Ravana was roaming the world. Meanwhile, in the dynasty of Dasarath, in Ayodhya, a great powerful ruler. At that time, it is said that Ayodhya was the hub of the world. In fact, the world government had its seat in Ayodhya at that time, and the emperor of the world. So Ayodhya was a very powerful, very ornate city. Dasarath had a nickname, or his name, Dasarath, really was a title given to him because of his great prowess in battle, that he could fight in 10 directions at the same time. According to the Vedic idea, if you cover 10 directions, you cover all directions. North, west, south, east, the directions in between, up and down. That covers all directions. So Dasarath was able to simultaneously fight in all directions. Because Dasarath was a fighter who would not just fight with ordinary military art, but Dasarath controlled celestial weapons. And because of that, Dasarath was able to control so many. Therefore, he had everything he could desire. Only one thing was lacking: a son. So anyway, in the beginning of the book, the Balya Kanda, we find a description of a great sacrifice that is being performed, and Dasarath is getting, after that sacrifice is performed, as it was the practice in that time, the sages that performed the yajna, the sacrifice, something like what we have here, but for another purpose. A fire was lit for begetting progeny. And because of the potency of the sages, a personality appeared from that yajna, from the fire, and carried with him some milk rice, which was invested with the potency for having children. So when that was distributed amongst the wives, three wives of Dasarath, finally there was pregnancy, and four sons were born, out of which Ram was the prominent one, not just an ordinary personality, but rather Lord Ramachandra was the incarnation or avatar of Narayan. His brothers were none other than Sankarsan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, the further expansions of the Lord. So in this way, all four of these brothers were endowed with spiritual power. So, in the end of the Balya Kanda comes the period of the Ayodhya Kanda. In the Ayodhya Kanda, we see how Ram is grown up, how he has attained mystic power from the sage Vishvamrita, and how Dasaratha decides to coronate Ram as the king of the empire. But then the young and most beautiful wife of the king, she, Kaikeyi, she somehow or other had in the past pleased the king very much, and he promised her two boons any time. She said, yes, I'll save it for later. And just on that occasion, she took these boons. And she said, for the first boon I'm asking, this was the day before the coronation, for the first boon I'm asking that Ram will be sent to the forest. For the second boon, I'm asking that my son Bharat will be crowned as king. Yes, that is what I want. Well, Dasarath was heartbroken, destroyed, could not even speak. But Ram took it completely peaceful, completely unaffected. Ram, completely transcendental, didn't care whether he was here or there. Whatever his father desired, whatever destiny would bring, he would simply accept. So Ram was asked to go for 14 years to the forest and happily went there. His wife Sita went alone, and the next portion of the Ramayana or the Ramayana is called Aranyakanda, or the forest pastimes. So there in that forest, obviously life in forests is not always easy. There are not only all kinds of wild animals, but in those days there were also rakshasas, cannibals living in the forest, powerful rakshasas. So it was a little difficult at times. But, and there was one particular personality who lived there in that forest, a rakshasa, who had some arrangement with human beings living in the forest, that every once in a while one was offered as a sacrifice. And if that was nicely followed, then he would not just randomly eat people. So only a chosen one. Anyway, that didn't work out so successfully for him, because in the end, he was killed, revenge was being taken, and Lord Ramachandra defeated 14,000 rakshasas. So, so many of such pastimes happened in the forest. The key element in the story is that Ram's wife, kidnapped by Ravana, the demoniac king, taken away to the south, but otherwise destination unknown. And then begins the period where Ram, along with his brother Lakshman, is searching and searching for Sita. Finally, they come to a place in the south, in South India, and they make a connection with a monkey army, right, which is the army that will help them to finally conquer Lanka, finally there regain Sita, kill Ravana, and in that way we kind of have the theme for the night. It's a very long story, and to do the whole thing justice, I think it would take me 4 hours if I really want to do it dramatically. I could, but maybe this evening is not designed for that. So I'll do something else. I decided to take the Kiskindha Kanda as the as my focus for the evening. So I've given you sort of the outline of the story in case you are not so familiar, for your orientation. So now I'm going back to the point where Ram went south and connected with the monkeys. So Ram and Lakshman were roaming through the forests in South India and was spotted by Sugriva. Sugriva, the king of the monkeys, right, who was in exile, who had been driven out of his kingdom, and his kingdom was Kiskindha, but he had to hide on a mountain, Rishyamukhi mountain, where he was protected from his enemy, because there was a curse on the head of his enemy that he could not go to that particular place, that as soon as he would ever come there, he would turn to stone. So it is stated. So that was the only safe place where Sugriva resided. His enemy was his brother. Somehow or other, between two brothers, this great enmity came about. Why? Because once a powerful demon had come to attack, while Bali, the elder of the two brothers, Bali and Sugriva, Bali was the ruling king at the time. Then that powerful demon came and they both chased that demon. Then the demon entered into a hole in the ground and Bali said to Sugriva, "You stand guard here. I'll go inside and I will kill that demon. Wait until I come out." A whole year went by. A whole year. He sat there. It's not easy to sit still for a monkey, especially for a whole year. And you have anybody who would find it hard, but especially a monkey is not known for sitting still. A whole year Sugriva sat there next to that hole. Never moved. Then one day he heard a terrible scream and blood started to ooze out of that cave. And then he heard the grunting of the demon, roaring. And not a sound from Bali. He said, "Oh my God, Bali is dead. He killed him. So immediately he rolled a big boulder, an enormous rock, in front of the entrance of the cave and closed it off. So then went back to the kingdoms, and informed the ministers, "I've waited for a whole year, Bali never came out, what can I say? Disaster. He's dead." The minister said, what to do now? The kingdom has to go on. There's only one solution. We'll crown you as king. So Bali being dead, Sugriva became the king. And after not too much time, Bali returned. He wasn't dead after all. He had killed the demon, came out of that cave somehow or other, and he took it that his brother had purposely locked him in the cave so that he could take over the kingdom. And Sugriva immediately was ready, stepped down from the throne. He said, "No problem, you return to the throne, I'll be your servant as before, I'm so happy you're still alive." Bali didn't want to hear. Bali, in fact, drove Sugriva out of the kingdom in one cloth only, and also took away Sugriva's wife. So Sugriva was very upset, obviously. And then Bali chased him, and Bali was more powerful and would beat him. What kind of monkeys were they? It is said that actually these monkeys were not ordinary monkeys at all. They were the sons of demigods, who somehow or other, by some arrangement, appeared in the form of monkeys. But not ordinary monkeys, extremely powerful monkeys. So there were others. So the minister of Sugriva was Hanuman, and Hanuman followed Sugriva in exile. So Hanuman was also there, and when they saw Ram and Lakshman come in the forest, then Sugriva thought, they're spies. They've been sent here by Bali to kill me. But Hanuman said, well, you never know. I mean, let me go and check it out. And Hanuman took the form of a Brahmana, because Hanuman had many mystic powers. So he took the form of a Brahmana, and Hanuman appeared before Ram and Lakshman and spoke in a very pleasing tone. He found the right note or the right words and spoke very nicely, inquiring from them why they had come to the forest, who they were, and what was their purpose, and so on. And then Lakshman began to explain everything about Lord Ramachandra, how he was banished to the forest, the whole story, what his, how his stepmother had asked for his bones, and therefore he had to go, and worse, that now his wife had been kidnapped by this terrible demon Ravana and taken away through the sky in a chariot that could fly in the sky, and was pulled by a donkey, flying donkey, believe it or not. So anyway, all this was recounted to Hanuman, and Hanuman, after testing the princes, took it that they were who they said they were. He could see, and they were noble princes, and he could see that they could become powerful allies of Sugriva. Therefore Hanuman said, please, gentlemen, be seated on my back. And he took a monkey form again, and somewhat bigger, and was large enough. They sat on his back, and he took them up the mountain, flew up the mountain to Sugriva. So in this way, in a short time, they met with Sugriva, and a pact was made between Ramachandra and Sugriva. In that pact, basically, Ramachandra agreed to assist Sugriva in regaining the throne to kill Bali. So, okay, everything was ready. They were ready to challenge. Oh, I forgot to mention, and Sugriva's part was that he would assist Ram to find Sita. Anyway, so Ram kept his part in the bargain. He went with Sugriva down the mountain where they were taking shelter, where Bali could not come because of the curse, went to Kiskindha, and Sugriva began to roar and call Bali bad names. So Bali was just enjoying in his palace when he heard this roaring of Sugriva. He said, what's going on? This upstart of a little brother of mine is again asking for another beating. Well, he can have it. And so he came. And sure enough, when he saw Sugriva, he pounced on him, and both the brothers got into a terrible fight. And Ram did not do anything. So Sugriva, somehow or other, was half killed and managed to get away to save his life, and said to Ram, why didn't you protect me? And Ram said, I couldn't see the difference between the two of you. You look exactly the same. I wasn't sure which one was which. So I didn't want to kill the wrong one. So then they put some flower garland, they tied it around the neck of Sugriva so that Ram could see which one was which. Then they tried it again, And this time Ram, from hiding behind a tree, shot Bali in the chest. Now Ram stands for the ultimate emblem of morality. Ram stands for the man who will always uphold religious principles, always lives by duty, always holds up high human ideals. So Bali got shot into the chest. He fell backwards. But Bali had a golden chain around his neck, which he had received from Indra. And this chain would keep him from dying. Even if he was severely injured, he would not die as long as he was wearing that chain. So even although the arrow was in his chest and he was bleeding profusely, he didn't die. So Bali was lying there and Ramachandra came. And then Bali regained some strength and spoke and said, "Ha! Are you Ramachandra? Are you the one who is supposed to be so noble? How could you interfere in what is what for fair combat? When two equals are fighting, how could you just interfere like that without openly challenging me? Is that dharma? Is that fairness? Is that morality? You see, you've been exposed for your sinful activity as a coward who shot me from an ambush without any warning, without a fair fight, without challenging me. So what kind of hero are you? You are no hero at all. It is just a false reputation. You will go to hell for this." Bali spoke in this way. Then Lord Ramachandra said, "My dear Bali," he said, "when you came to this battle, first of all, you had been drinking too much. And second of all, you became injured in this fight, and therefore you're not thinking clearly. So I'm not holding it against you, but you have totally misjudged the situation. Look at it like this." He said, you are the one who by violence, by unjust violence, drove out your brother. Not once, but you would torture him every day. Remember, O Bali, how you followed and chased your brother all over the world. Remember, O Bali, that your brother had to take shelter on that hill, Rishamukhi, where you could not go because you once had disturbed a sage's sacrifice, and you were cursed if you would go there to turn into stone. And do you remember that even when Sugriva was hiding there, that you wouldn't leave him alone? That daily you would fly through the sky in a big jump and somehow or other land with one foot on the head of Sugriva and give him a kick and then fly out on the other side, just so that you wouldn't touch the mountain. Just to give him a headache out of spite. So for this envious mentality, O Bali, for this envious mentality, you were at fault. And your sinful activities were amounting day by day. Said you are in the kingdom, of Bharat, who is now the ruler of the world. And we, his servants, are meant to keep law and order in that kingdom. And you, you were misbehaving. All right, maybe I was misbehaving. Maybe that is a fact. But Was that an excuse to kill me in a cowardly way? Was that right and moral for a king who upholds Dharma, principles of purity and religion? For the ideal king? Sorry, I don't buy it. That was a cowardly act. No, Ramachandra said. Look at yourself. You are not a Kshatriya. You are not a king who lives by rules of Dharma. You are a wild animal, a forest dweller, who follows these kind of standards. And it shows by your behavior. So the Kshatriya kings, they hide and shoot the wild forest animals from hiding. So what was wrong? Now that you were shot, now you are relieved from your sinful reactions, and you will attain the heavenly plans. So in this way, Bali could accept. Bali accepted it, and Ramachandra's reputation as the one who abides by Dharma was upheld. So this is sort of like an interesting portion of the Ramayana. You know, it is the portion where, like, to cast some doubt on Ram, that who otherwise comes out as the obvious perfect personality, who always does good in every situation. He does good, but here it looks a little more obscure, a little more doubtful. A little, even after my explanation, some may go like, well, I don't know if I'm really convinced by this. Maybe I'm still on Bali's side. Yes. No. Principles of Dharma require piety, require piety. The principles of Dharma require commitment. Those who are animals will not be able to commit to Dharma, because dharmena hina pasubhyasa samana, without Dharma, you're equal to an animal. So nowadays, of course, society at large is not necessarily adhering to Dharma, and therefore, according to the Vedic definition, a lot of people are actually behaving like animals. They're known as animals. Dvipadipasu, it is described, two-legged animals. Or sometimes it is said, besides the two-legged animal business, dvipadipasu, is also sometimes said pasu buddhi, animal intelligence. Right? Animal intelligence means friends and enemies. Prabhupada would many times use words and say people are like cats and dogs, they are like asses. And I just 2 days ago met a lady who was an astrophysicist in Durban. She was from the UK, and she was upset, you know, said like, your guru is calling people, is calling scientists asses. She didn't like that. What can I say? Well, I said to her, well, you know, like, when Prabhupada used the word ass, it may have been slightly different than what most of us would associate with it. Most of us would just say, you ass, you know, as a means to say brainless idiot or something, right? and possibly could think of other words also, but it's a little old-fashioned, you know. Nowadays they usually make it a little longer. Anyway, I'm leaving that up to the imagination of the audience. Whatever it is, so an ass. But Prabhupada was using the term ass in a somewhat extended understanding. Namely, Prabhupada was seeing that there was a Sanskrit word muda, which is translated as ass. But also, Prabhupada was looking at the ass as a prototype. An ass is a beast of burden. And the Vedic scriptures are repeatedly bringing forward the example of the ass as a beast that carries unnecessary burden, basically. So that's basically, the ass is the prototype of one who carries unnecessary burden. Yeah. So cats and dogs are the prototypes that fight without a reason, that fight for fighting's sake, but that fight without a real reason. So like that, Prabhupada used these kind of things, hogs, dogs, camels, asses, and the whole animal farm was sort of part of the vocabulary. But if you look, that's part of the Vedic metaphors, right? Because the camel is given as a metaphor of one who chooses thorns, branches with thorns, and it's so tasty. But what is he tasting? Is his own blood. Right? That makes it tasty, otherwise the thorns don't taste. So a person who, at the expense of his life energy, is wasting his life. That's the camel metaphor. One who spends all his energy on enjoying temporary fruits, but not taking advantage of the human form of life to really advance. So the Ramayana is offering us a king who's dedicated his life to spiritual advancement, not just of himself, but of humanity at large, particularly humanity, because it is in the human form of life that we can especially attain a spiritual goal. In the animal form of life, basically the consciousness is anamoy. It's about eating. Animals are only concerned with eating. So, animals are not necessarily following all the rules of Dharma. So tonight, of course, besides the celebration of Ramayana and the appearance of Lord Ramachandra, we are also performing initiation ceremonies, and I'm trying in this lecture to sort of bring it all together. So this, I'm trying to kind of draw out a little bit of deeper meaning. On other Ram Navamis, I have gone very dramatic, and I'll go a little dramatic again, don't worry, but a little intermezzo about Dharma. Lord Ramachandra's teachings are still the teachings that we are upholding today. Still, the same commitment to Dharma is still the absolute truth. It's not that the truth has changed in 1 million years. So whatever truth Lord Ramachandra was teaching then is still valid for us today. So therefore the values of the Ramayana are still values that are to be upheld by us today. The only difficulty is that at the time of Lord Ramachandra, people had more exalted character, and society at large was on a much higher plane than it is now. And at this stage, the individual has become very weak. So what is our strength to uphold Dharma? We see one example in the Ramayana, I'll go back a little earlier, when Ram was a young boy, and when when Ram was 16 years old, his father was so happy to have such a son. One day the sage Vishwamrita came. And Vishwamrita, a powerful sage, somewhat with a temper, known to have strong anger, Vishwamrita came, and Dasarath, the king, received him with the greatest honor. I am so blessed that a sage has come to my kingdom. Oh, my dear sage, how are you progressing in achieving the ultimate goal of life? How can I serve you? My dear king, what can I give you? Whatever you desire, it is yours. Then the sage Vishwamrita said, I want your son Ramachandra. No! Not Ram! No! 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 Oh no. I may be a king. I may be known for one who keeps his word throughout, but this time, forget it. I'm gonna break it. Forget it. I'm not giving him Ram, no way. Why do you want Ram? He's only a boy. He's only a boy. 16 years old. No, I want Ram to kill some Rakshasas. Rakshasas, they're very dangerous, powerful personalities, much more powerful than human beings. They eat flesh, they kill. How can a mere child fight with Rakshasas? I will personally fight. Me, Dasarath, I will go. I have celestial weapons. No problem. I'll finish them off at no time for you. Tell me, where are they? Let's go. Let's kill these Rakshasas. No, Dasarath. I want your son, Ram. I'm going to break my word. As simple as that. Forget it. You know, I may be known as a king who keeps his word under all circumstances. Well, that's over now. I'm not going to keep this one. But if I don't keep my word, then my son will see that I am not giving the proper example. Then I will spoil him. Then what kind of father am I? Then how can I not keep my word? But if I keep my word, then it will break my heart in 1,000 pieces. Don't worry, Dasarath, Vishwamrita said. I'm just taking him for a little while. I'll bring him right back. And anyway, an over-apprehensive father. And so we see the value of one's word. And that culture, at that time, one's word was so serious. But I'm bringing that out because Prabhupada would say, at the time of initiation, he would say, now you must do, because you have given your word. Now we are like, you know, so what, you know? I mean, so what? I gave my word, you know? Gave my word yesterday, and tomorrow I'll break it, you know? I mean, okay, change my mind, you know? Life changes, I change, my mind changes, yeah? You know, go with the flow, you know. You just take it as it comes, right? So this concept of keeping your word is not so deeply ingrained within us as it was in Dasarath, who just, you know, kept that word. When Kaikeyi asked for Ram to be sent to the forest, same dilemma. No! Not again, the word, you know. Yes, again he had to keep his word. And this time, by keeping his word and letting Ramachandra go to the forest, he died. He's an old man, he died. It was too much for him. He knew it. As soon as he said, okay, let him go to the forest for 14 years, he died. So we see that such principled behavior, very principled people. So yes, this initiation is also like that. It is also, one gives his word, and that word is for life. It's no question of breaking it. Cannot be broken. Amen. Because, as Prabhupada said, you've given your word. Well, anyway, so that's difficult for the modern mind, you know. And looking at ourselves, a little introspection sort of brings that out, from that our commitment to our word is not so strong. It's difficult to just function on, you've given your word. Therefore, although the Dharma of Ramachandra, the same standards are still applying today, we do not have the same strength of character to follow it. Then it says that in the Chaitanya Chandramrita, there is a mention which says that in the past, the Lord appeared to relieve the burden of the earth by killing many Rakshasas. That's what Lord Ramachandra did. He says, but now the Lord has appeared and relieves the burden of the earth by dancing on its surface. Referring to Lord Chaitanya. So Lord Chaitanya, the avatar for this particular age, comes, purifies the earth by dancing on the surface of the earth. I was also, soon there is a deadline for finishing a Vyasa Puja offering for Srila Prabhupada, so I was working on that. And I came upon one thing where it says, never trust a guru who doesn't dance. So that's important, okay, for tonight. Never trust a guru who doesn't dance. Yes. And how did Prabhupada dance? Old man danced and danced in front of the Rathcart in London like no one had ever danced. Held up the whole thing. The police told the old man to sit down. Anyway, no one cared about the police. The police told Prabhupada's servant, you tell the old man, and Prabhupada's servant said to the police, you tell him yourself, you tell him directly. And he was more afraid of Prabhupada than of the police. And then, you know, the police got heavy. So then he told Prabhupada, and Prabhupada just looked at him, and just by that glance, he became the size of a mouse. And he couldn't do anything. Police couldn't do anything. Prabhupada was dancing. And his dancing drove everyone mad. Everyone started jumping and flying. So, Prabhupada's dancing was not just an orchestrated ballet or something like that. Prabhupada's dancing was dancing out of happiness. Because that is the second quality. Guru must be happy. Right? It's his happiness that really is his strength. It is his, if he's just dutiful and faithful, if he's dutifully and faithfully living with the burden of Dharma, then his disciples will also dutifully and faithfully live with the burden of Dharma at best. He has to relish this Krishna consciousness. And that he must transmit. So, because that is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was transmitting. He was transmitting this happiness, this joy. So with happiness and joy in Krishna consciousness, with relishing, then we can do it. Then we can, the combination of these two, the combination of these principles of Dharma combined with happiness, then we can do it. That we need. So that happiness in Krishna consciousness, one element of happiness is giving, giving mercy to others. That brings happiness. That always brings happiness. When we see how destitute people are getting mercy, that is very nice. We were just in the Ratiyatri in Newcastle, and there was one bum off the street, right? I mean, he had like a cloud of alcohol smell of at least 2 meters around him. So it was serious, right? But he's old, but when the kirtan came by, it struck a chord, you know, something made him happy, and he started to dance, and he made funny moves, and he danced the whole way. And then at one point, one of the devotees started dancing with him. And then at one point, this devotee gave him a huge hug. Well, I'm sure that guy didn't have a huge hug for a long, long time. You know, that really lifted him up like anything. God, you know. He became actually happy, you know what I mean? For since long that he had been accepted by anyone and not chased away like a dog. Get out of here, you know, you animal. And, but for the first time since a long time, he was treated like a human being. And that mercy lifted him up, and also the devotee, right, who did that, became totally ecstatic. I saw it, and I also got a glimmer in my eyes from, hey, there's something is going on here. This is on the transcendental plane. This is on the plane of extraordinary generosity. And wherever we see that giving to uplift others, there we gain happiness. Then there's our internal life. One cannot just be fixed on Dharma by determination, or by intelligence. I've understood this philosophy, it makes sense, I am deeply impressed by it, I think it's the truth, I think I'm going to adjust my life to it. That's all intellectual, very nice. But then still it's a burden, and still it's a burden. So, one must also internally have an internal life, both. Give mercy and go and collect it. Give it and go and collect it. Dig deep in the scriptures. Dig deep in the scriptures. Because in the scriptures, there are amazing descriptions of amazing personalities. There we will find. Chant the name of the Lord. That name is unlimited. Invest energy. Do not chant mechanical. Really chant it. Chant it. Try and every day. Chant at the best time. Chant the best rounds. Make something out of that chanting. That is the internal life. So we must somehow or other have both internal life quality, and otherwise it waters down after a while, and suddenly the vows become a burden. Take these vows, and if we are not having internal life, then the vows become a burden, and then our so-called merciful activities become superficial, just a show. How can you have compassion when you don't have a better quality of life? You can only have compassion when you have a better quality of life. Otherwise, you can be like an actor on stage and act as if you are compassionate. That's possible. But real compassion is only possible when we have a better quality of life ourselves. Then it's natural. So we must endeavor for that. And rewards will come. We must fill the emptiness in our heart with many treasures. I used to keep a notebook from what I was reading. And well, there are different kinds of notebooks you can keep. You know, you can do a systematic analysis of a text, and you can just sort of look at the structure of the text and map it out. And there is some taste in that. But I didn't have much time for things like that. So what I did is I just wrote down things I liked in a notebook. And when it was full, then I started another one, and another one, another one, until I had a whole stack of notebooks that were full of things that I liked. So they're nice notebooks, actually. At least I think they're nice notebooks, because I wrote down only things in them that I liked. So they're kind of nice notebooks. Whenever I pick them up, I think, nice. So these are some, there I have some little valuable things I collected over the years. Oh, so many things are there. Memories of service. Oh yes. In 1984, it was the year that Srila Prabhupada's Murti was installed in the Samadhi in Vrindavan. And there was no space in the Samadhi. They did it in the courtyard of the Krishna Balaram temple. And then the construction people had built a table for bathing Prabhupada, and then made it very strong. They had made legs and like bars, you know, across the legs to keep the legs from moving. Good construction. The only problem was they didn't calculate that with the drum that was supposed to go under the table. They didn't calculate. The drum didn't fit. You couldn't get it under. So what to do? Everyone was looking at it, you know, Prabhupada was sitting on the table, some 500 kilos, and you know, how are we we couldn't lift the table, not 500 kilos, right? So what to do? I said, what to do now? As anyone, there was big leaders all came, the GBC came from a whole bunch of them, all looking what to do. I said, okay, it's fine. I'll go under there with my team with buckets. So I was under there with buckets, you know what I mean? And a bathing ceremony involves bathing with different substances. And I remember all of them. The milk, when it came down, splashed all over me. The ghee, you know? The ghee, oh God, you know? The ghee. Then the honey, when the honey came, you know? Whoa, you know, it came from everywhere and was everywhere. I got covered from head to toe in honey as well. Anyway, catching as much as I could in buckets under that table. So it splashed off Prabhupada all on me. I'll never forget that mercy I got. And I got kicked by all the senior Vaishnavas. Even Brahmananda stood on my hand with his 250 kilos or more. Oh my God. It was quite an experience. So So there are such highlights, you know, highlights of service, of surrendering service, of doing something in service, of doing something difficult in service, volunteering, or going to the desert in Rajasthan to buy trucks of marble. The hottest day in my life, 59 degrees. It was a bit warm. Loading trucks of stone. Oh, everything was cooking. So what can I say? Such things were there. So there's sacrifice to be made in service. When one is just having a comfortable niche in Krishna consciousness and one is not challenged in the service, then we begin to feel dry. And we begin to feel, I don't know, it's difficult, I'm trying to be a devotee, but it's just so hard. So we must feel that we are on the cutting edge in service, in our practices. Then there is life. Then there's life in our... then we feel we are dancing. We're part of that dancing movement. Dancing on the surface of the earth. That is needed. Yes. Dancing like Krishna's puppet in the hands of Krishna. Okay, so this was a little intermezzo about Dharma, some sort of deeper explanation, and also in the context of our current time. Now, meanwhile, you know, okay, after Sugriva and Bali and that whole matter was settled up, Sugriva was back on the throne. And yes, and Sugriva, what happened was 4 months went by and it was the rainy season and he didn't do anything for Ram. He forgot all about it. Sugriva was so happy to have returned to the palace. And Ram had a vow that he had to remain in the forest, so he couldn't visit the city. So Lakshman went, and Lakshman was so angry, he said, I'm gonna kill this Sugriva. He is surely just there enjoying his senses. Ram said, please don't do that, just bring in a message that maybe you should do something. Anyway, Lakshman's eyes were red hot, and he went into the city of Sugriva, came into the palace, and sure enough, came into the royal quarters, and half-dressed ladies and everything, and well, it was too much, too much. Sugriva had forgotten all about it. Fortunately, just the week before, there was someone had reminded, a minister, Hanuman actually had reminded Sugriva that he should do something, and Sugriva said, okay. So they sent out the word to call for many monkeys to assemble. So when that was shown to Lakshman, okay, he cooled down. Oh, that's okay. He's doing something. And yes, many monkeys were called, and all were very powerful, and all were invested with the potency of the demigods. So many. They were like enormous and powerful. These monkeys were dispatched to search in all directions, and it was thought that since it was said Sita went to the south, that the best would be sent to the south. Hanuman and Angada and some were sent, and Jambavan, they were all sent to the south. And Ram gave a ring to Hanuman because he felt that somehow or other Hanuman would be the one who would meet Sita. Then that whole story that basically they've looked everywhere in the south, couldn't find Sita anywhere, and basically Sugriva had given a tall order. Sugriva had said, you find her, and otherwise don't have to come back. You know, you don't have to come back. I mean, you know what I mean? As far as we're concerned, you're dead. Alright, so they got the message, you know. There was no returning. Returning meant like, you know, being dead. So they were looking and looking and they couldn't find anywhere. And just, yeah, well, finally, there was the help of that vulture, the elder brother of Jatayu, who had been killed, the younger vulture. And that vulture became an ally, and with his telescopic eyes, he saw Sita on Lanka and explained where she was. Meanwhile, all the monkeys then were very happy to know that she was on Lanka. Sita was on Lanka. They found Sita, and all they had to do was go there and get a message, but there was 800 miles of ocean in between. How to get across? So different, with, they were all speaking like, is there anyone who can jump across? And, you know, different monkeys saying, well, I could do it, and, but I don't know if I could come back, you know? And they could do it once, but then to come back, I don't know. They looked at Jambavan, can you? Jambavan said, I'm old, you know, I can do 700 miles, but not 800, you know, at my age. So no one could do it, and Hanuman was quiet. Because Hanuman had forgotten his power. Because when Hanuman was born into this world, Hanuman was also the son of Vayu and of a celestial lady who had been cursed to become, because of some inappropriate behavior, to become a monkey. So, but it was said that as soon as you give birth to a child, you can return to the heavenly planets. So she gave birth to Hanuman and she was ready to go. But Hanuman immediately grabbed her by the cloth and said, wait a minute, where are you going? She said, sorry, but you know, curse is over, I've got to go to the heavenly planets now. Everything's fine. He said, no, you're my mother and I'm hungry. Right? So what will I eat? She said, don't worry, eat anything that is red and round. Okay, red and round. So it was night when she left. So he's waiting for a long time, red and round, and then the sun was rising and it was red and it was round. So Hanuman was very powerful, so he jumped up in the sky and was about to eat the sun. And Indra just saw it in time. This monkey is about to eat the sun. So Indra threw his thunderbolt and hit Hanuman on the jaw and broke a little piece of his tooth. And then Hanuman, he fell unconscious from that blow. Well, Vayu became very angry. It was his son. So Vayu withheld all the air in the universe. So everyone started to suffocate, even the demigods themselves. So they decided this was also not good. So they all started to make offerings to Hanuman and pacify him. And, you know, and Hanuman was still quite angry. But finally, Brihaspati came and gave him the benediction that he would know, that he would have knowledge of all kinds of forest fruits that were edible. Then Hanuman was happy. And, but then, shortly after that, Hanuman again caused some disturbance. You know, and this time, some sage, some rishi, cursed him that he would forget his power until he was reminded. So it was then, at that time, that Jambavan, he knew about this, and Jambavan started to describe Hanuman's power and reminded him of his power. And then Hanuman suddenly remembered all his power and just regained his full strength, but now with maturity and so on. And Hanuman then took an enormous form and ran up a mountain and just jumped off that mountain. The mountain was sort of crushed into the ground and he flew through the sky towards Lanka. There, Hanuman, some demoness came who had a benediction that whoever would pass would have to enter into her mouth. So Hanuman, suddenly this huge mouth comes in front of him. So Hanuman became bigger. She became 10 miles. Hanuman became 15 miles. She became 20. He became 30. And then suddenly Hanuman became very small. Went into her mouth and out and said, so, now I've been in your mouth. Phew. And he went on. When Hanuman came to Lanka, he took the form of a very small monkey and entered into Lanka. At least he was about to go across the wall, but there was a powerful demoness who was guarding Lanka. And she appeared and said, "Stop, where are you going?" He said, "I'm a little monkey just going, and we're not going anywhere. Nobody goes inside Lanka." And then Hanuman said, "Look, you can't stop me." She said, "You know what I mean? Who are you, little monkey?" Yeah. He says, "Look, you know, if you keep on talking like this, I'll give you a slap." She said, "How can you give me a slap?" He said, "Just lift me up." She lifted him up, and he gave her a slap, and she just like smacked on the ground like this on his foot. That she just was defeated. And then she said, "Actually, there's a prediction that one day, when I will be defeated by a monkey, that day it will be the end of Lanka." And she let him in, and she ran off to tell Ravana, who didn't take it too serious. And, you know, it's like, you know, go home, you know what I mean? It's night, you know what I mean? This is time to enjoy, you know what I mean? Yeah. But anyway, Lakshman came in the palace of Ravana and saw all these queens in the night, very beautiful, not properly dressed, and so on. But Hanuman was not distracted. Not distracted, not attracted, because his mind was fixed on Ram. So there we see another point that is highlighted in the Ramayana, that we must... Yeah, when our mind is fixed on Krishna and on our service, see, Hanuman was not just chanting Ram, 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 but he was doing a mission for Ram, a service for Ram. So because that was his link, the service. So it is our service that is our source of strength. Then Hanuman finally met Sita. Yeah, so many things happened, of course. In the end, he brings the message to Sita from Ram, and then fights with a few of the Rakshasas, and one of a big general, Hanuman becomes huge, picks up a huge iron bar and hits the animal, the general on his head, and his head disappears in the body, and body is sort of squashed flat. So Hanuman sort of showed that he was quite powerful and just pointed out, "I am one monkey and a whole army is coming and you'll just be destroyed. Return Sita now. Your best chance is to fall at the feet of Ram, beg forgiveness and return Sita." But Ravana could not do that. Ravana basically said, like, you know, he said, whoever Ram may be, he's an ordinary human. Either he's an ordinary human and I will kill him, or he's Vishnu. But even if he will kill me, then what better to die in battle than, you know, to just lose my reputation. So in material life, everything is for the external, what people believe, what people think of us, and we're ready to die for it. So spiritual life requires this humility, and this is what is needed. Now I'm going to wind up this lecture and bring it to the initiation, because time is moving fast. So just in a so today we can pray for strength to Lord Ramachandra, and to all his associates, Hanuman, Lakshman, Sita, that we have the strength to keep our vows. That's a special blessing on this day. That's why it's important to take initiation on a day like this, because on this day there are these added blessings. And initiation, not only the ceremony, but to afterwards bring it to its success, always depends on blessings. So always look for blessings. Blessings of the Supreme Lord, and blessings of great devotees, either from the past or from the present. But always, by always seeking blessings, we'll make it, we'll be successful. Mm. Yeah. So my role is to give you good advice now, and to, after the initiation, to continue to guide you. Also, I'm supposed to pray for you, for your benefit, and on the strength of whatever service I have done, pray that Krishna may accept your service. So my prayer is there, and that he'll take you back to Godhead at the end of life. So all that is there. At the same time, though, I cannot be always there. In the Chandogya Upanishad, there are three types of spiritual masters described. One is like the bird, who feed their young constantly, right? Endlessly, like flying on and off. The other one is like the fish, who supervises but lets its young sort of go on its own, but is there at a time of danger. And the third is like the tortoise, who places the eggs in the sand of the beach and waits for the sun to create heat, and then the eggs germinate. So it's gonna be a bit of all three, you know. Sometimes I do some, I'm really ready to come in and, you know, give lots of personal attention. Other times it's really cold as a fish. or even worse, you know, the turtle, you know, meditating on a distance for the well-being of the disciple. Don't forget that the spiritual master is our ever well-wisher, and that we should not think, oh, he hasn't answered my mail. We should not think, I don't have a relationship with him. If we think that we don't have a relationship with our spiritual master, then it means that the fault lies with us. It means that we are not coming forward in service. And it means there's something lacking in our service attitude. Because when we think the spiritual master is the one who has to do all these things, you know, he has to come and inspire me, he has to say deep things, he has to do psychoanalysis on me and understand, you know, fully understand me better than I understand myself, and then he has to enlighten me, you know, in that, you know. So I have to be able to feel that, you know, that he says things that are deep and profound, that kind of go really deep like that. No. He may or he may not. Prabhupada said, I'm instructing my disciples intimately in public. I really like that. I mean, intimately in public. So much is said in public. So we must somehow or other keep that in mind. That the onus is on us as disciples to dedicate ourselves. We should understand the spiritual master is always dedicated. Even if he doesn't give us much attention, still his well wishes, his prayer for us is there. And he's always thinking, yes. Like, he may have so many disciples, and he may not have the time to speak to each of them. But still, for each of these disciples, there is his prayer to Krishna that the mercy may come. And he's meditating like that. So we should not underestimate what is really going on behind the scenes. Okay, I think we'll just take the vows and then take it from there.